Colonel Smiley, are you fine?
Yes, Baba Fire was the name of the, he's sometimes called Baba Mustafa and sometimes Baba Fire. And he was a Muslim priest. And he used to wear his sort of chef's hat that the sort of priest wore and cross belt. I remember going to a christening once, and before he christened the child, he put his Tommy gun on the altar and then christened this child. I'm sorry, I'm getting mixed up now, because I'm mixing him up with another Baba who is not a Muslim. Baba Fire didn't do this, another Baba did this, who was a Orthodox, because you don't have christenings in Muslim churches. Baba Fire led the gang, and he was always in his priest's robes and his chef's hat with a couple of bandoliers stretched across him and always carrying a Tommy gun. But the other Baba, who was an Orthodox one, I went to the christening of this child, and he put his Tommy gun on the altar and christened the child with parachute cord. He used parachute cord for sort of putting the cross on its forehead and so on. And we were all we were godfathers, Billy McLean and I, and that particular child. We had to give a gold sovereign to the we didn't give it to the parents, we gave it to one of the children to give to the parents after we left. The parents wouldn't take money like that, but you had to do it in an underground way, you know. You gave it a small child and say, give us to daddy when we've gone, which they did. But there's a lot of gold involved. We had gold sovereigns as our currency. We spent, I kept the accounts, I know I spent 50,000 gold sovereigns the first 6 months I was there. And they were used for all sorts of things, like buying mules and paying the mule men, buying our own food. In fact, one even paid guerrilla bands by results. If they blew up a bridge, we'd give them 100 sovereigns, that sort of thing. And there's also quite a lot of bribery. We got the plans of the oil fields in Kucho, rather important oil fields, and that was done entirely with bribery. And eventually the head man from the oil fields came out and gave us all the plans, where to blow it up and everything. It was quite useful.
How do you spell Kucho?
K-U-C with a cedilla, O-V-E. It's their big oil fields. All this, in fact, is in my book, which...
Since you've given all the detail in your book, Albanian Assignment, mm-hmm. Can we go on now to how you came to be transferred to Siam?
Yes. When the Germans quit the Balkans, we all came out of Albania, and I went back to Cairo. And it so happened that when I was in Cairo, I met a Siamese who was a very great friend of mine. Now, this goes back rather a long way. When the King of Siam abdicated in the 1930s, his name was King Pradijipok, he settled in England at Virginia Water with a large family. And his brother-in-law was a chap called Suba Savasti. Well, I knew all the family well, because my mother had a house on the Wentworth Golf Course very close to Virginia Water, and we saw a lot of Siamese. I used to play tennis with them. I had an airplane in those days, and one of them had, and we used to go flying together. I saw a lot of them. Anyway, I met Suba Savasti in Cairo, and he said to me, what are you doing? And I said, I don't know. War is over for me in the Middle East. I expect I'll have to go to the Far East. He said, well, why don't you come and join me? We're starting a Siamese section in SOE, and I'm the head of it. So I said I would. So I went back to London on leave and went to Baker Street, the headquarters in SOE, and said Chin Svastin he'd like me to come and join him in Siam. And so I straight away put in the Siamese country section, flown out to India, and went on a course of jungle warfare down in Ceylon, and then eventually was parachuted into Siam. I mean, there's a lot between then. I mean, I can talk a lot between what I did. I stayed with the Wavells, in fact, and they were friends of the family, and it was rather fun staying there at Vice Regal Lodge. And I'd had this course, which was quite a tough course, rather interesting course, the jungle school of jungle warfare, because all the students on the course were, I think, about a quarter to a third may have been British, but all the rest were, again, locals going back. There were Siamese, there were Chinese, there were even Japanese being trained in this school, and they were all going to be parachuted. In fact, they all were, and quite a few Gurkhas as well, in fact. But it's quite an interesting school. Then I went back to the headquarters of the SOE. It was then called Force 136. It changed its name frequently. I mean, when I was in the Middle East, I joined SOE when it was called MO4. And when I was in Albania, it changed its name from 133 to 266399. I think it had about four cover names. And when I went out to the Far East, it was definitely 136. It stayed 136 for the rest of the war. And the headquarters of 136 was in Calcutta. And there they had the different country sections. I mean, they had a Burmese country section, and Malaya, or what have you. And the French were working from there as well. There were quite a lot of Frenchmen in French Indochina who came under the SOE office in Calcutta. And I had a lot to do with them later when the war ended. But
whilst you were with 136, did you come across its head, Charles Hercules Mackenzie?
Charles Mackenzie, yes. CHM, we called him, yes. I did, yes.
Under what circumstances did you meet him?
Merely, I met him before I went in Calcutta. I was sort of introduced to him. And I didn't see him again until after the war. And then he wrote me an extremely nice letter because I was, put it bluntly, I was put in for a DSO and I got an OBE and I was very sort of upset about that. And he wrote me a very nice letter saying that military OBE was worth a DSO, and, which it wasn't, in fact. But quite a lot of people who were put in for decorations got sort of lower ones than they were put in for. And as I say, I was slightly annoyed to get an OBE when I knew I'd been put in for a DSO. But never mind.
What was your flight into Siam like? Did it all go straightforwardly?
No. Very funny. We took off from Jessore, which is in northeast of Calcutta, an airfield there, and I was in a Liberator. I'd been over the area where I was going to drop on a previous dropping operation, only supplies. No British bodies had yet dropped into Siam. And that was rather a hazardous operation because on the way back, something caught fire in the aeroplane, and we had quite a business putting the fire out, and then an engine stops. And it really was rather, for me, nerve-wracking trip, because it was a 14-hour trip, 7 hours each way, which is quite a long way to fly. This was in a Liberator, which was specially adapted with extra tanks for the petrol and a chute going down out of the back underneath the rear gunner, so that when you were parachuted, you could only do four. And when I did go on my proper operational drop, I went first. I then had two Siamese detective inspectors from Bangkok CID who were interpreters, and then my wireless operator, who's a splendid man called Collins. He was a sergeant. He'd been with me in Albania, and I asked for him specially to come with me to Siam. He was a gunner, in fact, by trade, but he was a wireless operator. And the four of us were supposed to go out, me first. Well, we got over the dropping zone at about 6 in the morning. It was just daylight. And the dropping zone was paddy fields, and there was a reception committee there waiting for me. And I shot out. When the dispatcher said go and a green light went on, I shot out and came down. And I looked up as I came down, and nobody followed me. I landed in the paddy field. It was nice and wet and easy landing anyway. I had a bottle of whiskey strapped to my leg for present for the man on the ground, and the aeroplane disappeared in the distance, and I couldn't think of what had happened. And then about 2 or 3 minutes later, it appeared again, and the other three came out, and I said, what's happened? And apparently the Siamese behind me took fright and held onto the side of the chute and wouldn't go out. So the aeroplane had to go and do sort of 5-mile circle while the other people got to work on him. And by the time he came over the dropping zone again, he went out. But whether he went voluntarily or was pushed, I think it's more likely the other two pushed him out. He was very embarrassed when he got down. Poor fellow, he must have been very frightened. He had done a parachute course, though. But anyway, I landed there and I was met by a very nice man who's Siamese, who had been student at Edinburgh University, a medical student, and he spoke perfect English. And he was the contact on the ground, and then I very soon met the leader of all the resistance in the area, who was the local MP, in fact. His code name was Pluto. And from then on, I really had rather a good time until I had a most ghastly accident. When I first arrived, I went round all the various groups of guerrillas, and my job was to, A, try and get supply drops for them, and then train them in Bren guns or whatever it was. And they were in camps. And there were quite a lot of Japanese about in the area. But the Siamese were completely double-crossing the Japanese. And on most occasions, for instance, I used to get a message from the Siamese army saying, look, we've got to lead the Japanese to one of your camps. Will you please go away? And so we'd go away, and the Siamese would lead the Japanese to an empty sort of camp, you know. And but they always gave us warning before they were coming. His leader of the Siamese resistance was the president, a man called Pradit, Luang Pradit. And he lived in the regent's palace. He was regent and president. And the... No, he wasn't president, I'm lying now. He was a regent. And he lived in the royal palace and had on the top floor of the royal palace a British brigadier with his wireless operator. Now, this brigadier had been into Siam. He was the first... I was the first British to be parachuted, but this chap had been into Siam long before me. But he'd gone in by Catalina flying boat and then rowed to the shore. His name was Jakes, Victor Jakes. He was a lawyer by trade in Bangkok before the war, spoke the languages and all that, and was a very good chap. And most extraordinary setup, really, because this Ruth, as we called him, that was the code name of the regent, he'd be having a meeting with the Japanese every day, because the Japanese had already occupied Siam, and Siam was at war with us. They were forced by the Japanese to declare war on us. And so we were officially at war with Siam. Anyway, after the meeting he'd have every day with the Japanese, he'd go upstairs to the attic and tell Victor Jakes what was going on, and Victor Jakes would send signals which would be on Mountbatten's desk that day. I mean, Mountbatten had the knew exactly what was going on through Victor Jakes and the regent. And my particular leader in my area, who was called Pluto, his code name, and his real name was Nai Chieng Sirikandra, and he was a splendid man. He was a great friend of Ruth, so they were both members of the same party in the Siamese, I don't know what they call it, Legislative Assembly or something like that, sort of House of Parliament anyway. And eventually, things were going extremely well, and we were also building an airstrip in the middle of the jungle to take an airplane which could land from our side of the lines. At that moment it couldn't, of course, because we were 7 hours away by Liberator. But as the war got closer, we hoped to be able to use our landing strip for Dakotas and things. Anyway, one day I don't know what I was doing, but somebody came dashing into the camp saying the Japanese are about half a mile away and we must scram. I had with me a briefcase, which was a sort of made by the sort of special effects people in SOE, and it had 6 pounds of thermite in the bottom, and could be used either as a booby trap, you could leave it and whoever opened it blew themselves up, or if you wanted to destroy secret documents and things, you could put the documents in the briefcase, press a button, and after about 5 seconds it would explode. Well, I was in fact packing my code books and various signals I'd been receiving into this briefcase, and it exploded in my hands. It must have short-circuited somewhere, and 6 pounds of thermite blew up, and I was extremely badly burnt, because thermite's a very strong, I mean, it's what you use for incendiary bombs and that sort of thing. And my hands were burnt, my knees were burnt, my face was burnt, my eyes were closed. I couldn't open them. I shut my eyes when the thing went off, and I couldn't open them again. And to cut a long story short, I was nearly 3 weeks in Siam before they got me out. and my wireless operator and Kong, this medical student, looked after me. There were no medical supplies. They told me to keep the burns wrapped up, which I did with parachute stuff, and it was all very painful. Then I got maggots in my wounds, and that was even worse when they started eating the live bits. And it was really rather horrible. Anyway, they got me out eventually. In a rather peculiar way, a Siamese squadron leader took a Japanese fighter, who was a trainer, actually, a fighter trainer, from Karat, and landed on the strip which we'd been building, and pushed me into the back of, I was pushed into the back of this thing. He then flew me to another underground landing strip, much further to the west, nearer to Burma, on the Burmese border. And then a Dakota came in and picked me up and took me out to a hospital in Calcutta, where I spent a certain amount of time in hospital, having my burns treated, and then I went on leave, where I stayed up in Simla with the Wavells. And that was rather an interesting experience, because I happened to be staying with the Wavells at the time of the conference he had up there with the three leaders, Gandhi and Nehru and Jinnah, and I met them all as I was a guest in his house, and they came to meals and things. And the thing I can remember most about that was one night he had them to dinner and took them afterwards to the cinema. He had a private cinema in his house, and he showed the film of the liberation of the German concentration camps, which were nauseating, to say the least, but true. And you know, when those three men came out, they said, what wonderful sort of propaganda. How did you make those films? How did you get all the actors and things? They didn't believe it was true at all. They thought it was a completely fake film for propaganda purposes. They obviously got to realize it eventually, but not that particular evening. I remember it quite well.
All three of them thought that, did they?
Yes.
Can you put some dates on all this? When you went into Siam, when you came out, and when you were with the Wavells?
Yes. I think I went into Siam, I think in March of 45, and I was only there about 6 weeks before I had this explosion and came out. And then, just before the war ended, I went back in again. And I hadn't been there more than about, I think 2 or 3 weeks. And things were going very well when the atomic bomb went off. And then I had my work really started, because when I was in Siam originally, my orders were not to shoot Japanese. It was entirely intelligence collecting, orders of battle and where they were and all that sort of thing, airstrips, everything, entirely intelligence. And so we never got a shot fired in anger, really, all the time I was in Siam during the war. But later on, things became very different. My first job, of course, was to liberate a prisoner of war camp, which I had in my area, in a place called Ubon, U-B-O-N. I wanted to liberate it as soon as I'd heard the armistice had been made, but they wouldn't let us surface. The office in Calcutta, and I suppose it was Mountbatten's orders, that we weren't to surface to show ourselves until it was quite clear what the Japs were going to do, because they might have murdered the prisoners, they might have shot us or anything. But then we got a code word after about 3 days, and then we were able to surface, so to speak, and I went straight to the prisoner of war camp with quite a big gang of Siamese guerrillas. And the Japanese from then on behaved absolutely impeccably. They laid down their arms. Well, first of all, it was the most emotional thing. There were 4,000 prisoners at Ubon, 2,000 British, and 2,000 Dutch, and about 100 Australians and 4 Americans, and they all paraded on parade, and they had a magnificent officer with them called Philip Tuzi, who was, he wasn't with them all the time, because the officers and the NCOs were kept apart, but when the atomic bomb dropped and they sued for peace, the Japanese let a lot of British officers out of the camps they were in to rejoin their units in there were a lot of Argyles, and Toosey actually was a gunner. He was a gunner from Liverpool. He actually got a DSO for his work in the war in the prison camps. He was a splendid example. He's dead, I'm afraid. But he had all these chaps on parade, and they sang God Save the King, and they sang the Dutch national anthem, and it was all terribly emotional. They were all absolutely stark naked, except for a ball bag. They had nothing else, and most of them had sort of bellies from what they call rice bellies, from starvation, really. It sounds odd having a belly when you're starving, but you do. And I had the first 3 weeks was clearing the prisoners out of the camp back to England as quickly as we could, but it took about 3 weeks, and during that time we had to lay on entertainment and race meetings and God knows what else, even brothels. And at the same time I had a Japanese division in the area which I had to take the surrender of, and then by then two or three more people had been parachuted in to me to help me. And we had to count all the numbers of Japanese there were, which came to about 24,000, I think. They lined them all up in blocks of 100, 10 across and 10 deep, and we went down counting all these. Funny enough, I didn't do the counting. There were one or two people, British officers with me, who did all the counting, and I had to stand in front of the Japanese colonel or general, whatever he was, and they were sort of shouting out orders. Took about half an hour to shout out all their orders, and meanwhile the British officers were going around counting them all. And then they took us into the hospital where we had to count the wounded. They even made their poor bloody wounded get out of bed and stand to attention by the beds while they were counted. Half of them were dying anyway. I didn't think it was very kind. But anyway, we did all the counting, and we collected all their arms, which we handed over to the Siamese. The Siamese straight... You see, the Siamese were going to come over to us when Mountbatten launched his big invasion of Burma, which never took place because of the atomic bomb. But it was all planned, and the Siamese army... And, well, the whole lot were just going to turn on the Japanese. And we've been training Siamese officers in our, well, that school in Ceylon and places, jungle warfare school and so on. We've been training Japanese officers, I mean Siamese officers, for the great day which never came. So that was the end of the sort of war, as far as I was concerned, fighting the Japanese. But then the next thing that happened was far more... hazardous. The Japanese had taken a lot of French prisoners. They'd killed all the men. In fact, they shot summarily all the French colonial officials were all murdered by the Japanese, but the mass of women and children. And they were in a camp in what I called French Indochina. It was really Laos, the province of Laos. And I heard they were there, and I went over to see them. And the Japanese liberated them, let them free. They were all under guard in a sort of civilian compound. And within 24 hours, the communists, the Annamite, we call them Annamite communists, they eventually became Viet Minh, took these people hostage again and wouldn't give them up. And there were French officers there. And I had to cross the river, the Mekong River, which is very wide, was the boundary between Siam and Indochina. And I had to go across frequently to see what was going on. And on one occasion, in order to get these hostages liberated, I sent a signal back to Mountbatten's headquarters saying, could I rearm some of our prisoners of war who had volunteered to come with me to help release these wretched hostages? And the message came back, certainly not. They've been prisoners for 3.5 years. And you want to get them home as quickly as possible. But you can rearm a company of Japanese. So I then rearmed a company of Japanese and took them into Indochina. And we fought a pitched battle with these Vietnamese and released, and we won. I mean, we killed quite a few, and they withdrew. And we got all these women and children and nuns, quite a lot of nuns, and we got them all back over the Mekong to Siam.
What condition were they in?
Well, they were terrified because they had the communists were much more brutal, really, than the Japanese to these people, and they were terribly frightened. But once they got across the river into our Siamese hands, where the Siamese were extremely good to them, provided them with, I think they had a hospital or something put at their disposal, and they were very, very good. But they were all right. I mean, they were not well fed. I mean, they weren't starving or anything like that.
How had the Annamites been brutal?
Well, they were sort of knocking them about. I know. Well, I can tell you several different stories about that. But what I was going to say was the worst thing about this Annamite business was that they had American OSS officers with them. And at this stage of the war, the Americans and British were thoroughly opposed in policy. I think the Americans, I don't know whether they thought the British were going to sort of reimpose themselves in Siam, which we certainly weren't. But they were working hand in glove with these Annamites. And I had a particular bad case of Peter Kemp was with me at the time. I had Peter Kemp and somebody called Roland Wynne, my two closest officers. And Peter Kemp was across the river with a very nice Frenchman called Francois Klotz. And they were seized by these Annamites. And there was an American team there, four OSS men there as well. And we thought we were sort of cooperating. And suddenly the Annamites said, You're a prisoner. This is to Peter Kemp and Francois Klotz. So Peter sort of protested, said, I'm a British officer, this, that, and the other. And eventually said, all right, you can go, but we're going to keep Klotz. And Peter Kemp said, I'm not going without Klotz. He's my friend, and he comes from across the river with me, came across the river with me, and I'm going to take him back. Whereupon one of the Annamites went round behind Klotz and shot him in the back and killed him. And the four Americans were watching at the time. And Peter said, aren't you going to do anything to help? And the senior officer there, whose name I know, remember this day, called Banks, said, guess we're neutral here, and strolled away. And this wretched Frenchman, Francois, died in Peter Kemp's arms. And he brought the body back across the river, and we buried him that day. But, I mean, the Americans were definitely siding with these communists. And it wasn't until later, when the head of the OSS was murdered in Saigon by these people, that they realized, I think, they'd been backing the wrong side. But it was entirely due to the Americans that the war in the Vietnam was entirely their fault it started, because they were arming these wretched communists.
Going back to Ubon,